Listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson, and for the next hour, we're basically going to be eating stuff and talking about food as well. I'm joined by my fellow presenter, Guy Routledge of Food Rush. Hi, Guy.
Hi, Sue. How are you doing?
Good, good. Ollie Lloyd hasn't been with us for a little while, has he, for on these programs?
I think he's been jet-setting somewhere, so I hear anyway. So I hope he's somewhere nice and cold and wet and miserable.
Really mean. So he's the chief exec and co-founder of Great British Chefs. He missed a really good one in particular a couple of weeks ago when we had Patricia Michaelman, and we just spent all afternoon tasting cheese.
We did indeed.
Well, and chocolate as well, actually.
Chocolate and cheese, an interesting combination that I don't think I've ever had before. But it was a new one on me, but it was absolutely delicious. And we have more delicious things in the studio today, which is very exciting for me in particular.
Yes, so we're joined by Jim Fennell, the Salubrious Sauce Company. Well, I'll try saying that when you've had a drink.
And Paul, it's a mouthful.
Yes, Paul Rothstein from Great British Biscotti. And we know Paul's brand quite well. You've won one of our Food Talk Awards, haven't you?
That's right, yep. Mm-mm. Great honour.
He's won lots of awards.
He's won loads of awards, and we eat a lot of those in our office, so we're very familiar with those. I don't think Jim's tasted many, so you're going to be our little taster for biscotti.
Sure, my pleasure.
But first of all, let's talk about sauces. British people love sauce. They love sauces. Not in the French, you know, cooking sauce way, but like a little bit of sauce on the side of sausages, on the side of
condiments is what we're talking about.
That was the kind of one of the things that got it started for me, was having a cupboard and a fridge full of condiments.
Yeah, I mean, I've got loads.
Yeah,
and sometimes I have a little root and I go, oh, I forgot about that one.
Exactly.
It's right at the back.
Exactly. And now I'm part of that, so
it's been there since 1967, but it seems fine. Yeah,
exactly.
I'll still give it another go.
They do seem to last a while, don't they? It's brilliant.
I absolutely love them. So now, Guy, when you have breakfast, I have to say I prefer a bacon sarnie to a sausage sarnie, but what's your favourite?
It depends on the sausages, but I guess I would probably agree with you. I cook bacon more than I cook sausages, although I cook a lot of chorizo, which I guess is a form of sausage. I love a bit of chorizo.
For breakfast, though, if you're having a bacon sarnie, is it tomato ketchup or brown sauce?
Usually tomato.
Tomato. See, I'm a brown sauce person. And what you've got here, though, is something called breakfast sauce.
So
are you making me veer towards tomato ketchup?
So you're my two perfect customers.
Right.
So we've got one red and one brown. So I was very much in that camp as well. There were certain scenarios where I'd want to have brown sauce, certain scenarios I'd have tomato ketchup. And, you know, there was a kind of sort of process there. I just thought, well, okay, how about something somewhere in the middle? Maybe with a bit of a nod to brown, a nod to red, with, you know, certain other sort of slight chili bite to it. And that was just a reflection of the kind of things I liked.
Because my friends are not very well brought up. They have a bit of both, which I think...
Do you have any of those, Sue?
I thought
you were very refined.
No, not really. No, I think that's a disgrace, especially when you're older and you think you can't put both on.
It's such a British thing, though, isn't it? You know, it's that nagging question, which is, you know, part of our kind of description of the sauce. It does answer that red or brown question.
Well, I'm going to have a little taste.
It's a blend of the two, is it?
There's a lot more kind of science and art that goes into the creation of the recipe.
I didn't try to infer that you went down to the supermarket, picked up a classic red sauce and a classic brown sauce, and blended the two and put them in a new bottle.
It does have a certain uniqueness to it. I think I always say trying in isolation any condiment is... It can be quite challenging because, you know, how often would
Paul, have a try of that. Yeah.
If you take a spoonful of mustard and try it in isolation, you know. So, unfortunately, I didn't bring a full English or a bacon sandwich with me today.
Which is a shame.
It's a bit poor on your part.
It is.
Absolutely delicious. Really good.
The process we use to make it is we actually caramelize some onions down. So we get that kind of deep, sweet caramelized onion flavor. And then we add in some of the flavors that you would find in a brown sauce, some of the spices.
Oh, I like that.
And then obviously with with a kind of tomato base to it. So
It almost tastes like a tomato consommé that you would get in a fancy restaurant.
It's actually got body to it. It's got really, it's not really just a sauce. It's
deeply tangy.
Sort of having a full English breakfast is a bit of a luxury item, but you do, you know, you do need something that does stand up to the richness of a fried egg. You know, the strong sort of saltiness of bacon. So that does have that kind of like tang and depth of flavour.
And it's got a little bit of slight chili peppery.
Yeah, there's
bite.
A bit of a kick to it. There's a bit of something else kind of spicy in there as well.
Yeah, there's obviously a secret blend.
Oh, it's a secret recipe.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's, we wanted to try. I wanted to make something that was unique. You know, I mean, there are some great tomato ketchups out there. There are some great brown sauces out there. I just wanted to try and find, you know, plough our own furrow, come up with something that was different, but not too far out the ballpark that people would be like, oh my God, that's just crazy. So, you know, it's in that kind of comfort zone of flavor profiles, but
I'm going to get some of that.
The thing that is really stands out to me about it and being different to other, you know, red or brown sauce is that it's not sweet.
Yeah. You know, in fact, you know, from the nutritional point of view, factually, you're absolutely right, because it's lower in sugar and salt than a premium brand sort of tomato ketchup.
I'm sorry, I do think it's got a slight sweet.
There is a sweetness to it,
but it's fruit sweet.
Yes, but there has to be whenever you're cooking tomatoes, because they have that quite bitter edge to them.
Yeah,
this has still got that kind of crispness, whereas, you know, the classic tomato sauce is just, you know, it's so full of sugary sweetness.
Yeah, I think that the kind of holy grail is that kind of sweet with a bit of heat, you know, with a bit of saltiness, with a bit of acidity. So it does cut through the richness. And that's really where I was trying to balance the flavour profile and the ingredients.
Well, I think you've done well there.
Absolutely. It's interesting the way that you kind of mentioned each of those four things, which is, you know, the sweet, the salty, the spicy, and another one.
Bit of umami going.
Yeah, the umami. And that's almost a very kind of Asian approach. You know, they have those kind of four
absolutely
spokes or what have you.
And I think a reflection of where the food industry is moving at the moment. You know, there's that, all those influences that we've got, fantastic influences. So yeah, I mean, there was definitely a kind of an awareness of those, like you say, the umamis and things like that.
I've got another question for you now, Guy.
Go
when you have
it.
Sunday lunch, my favourite being roast beef,
it's got to be
rare, and then you get all that lovely fat that comes out that goes over all the potatoes, you know, a little bit of caramelisation going on, got to have Yorkshire pudding,
of course,
all the vegetables, all that sort of stuff. Do you have horseradish or do you have mustard?
I'm a horseradish man.
I veer between the two. What are you thinking, Paul?
I'm definitely a horseradish
person. With beef, horseradish. If I'm having pork, then mustard.
Right, you have to try this now.
So, is this another combination of the two?
It's another one.
Yes, so it is. It is. So you've got that unique horseradish flavour in our Sunday lunch sauce, but it's coupled with a bit of mustard. You've got some mustard seed in there. You've got some black pepper. You've got some rosemary and thyme. Mm. So it's got a real punch to it.
It starts off with horseradish and finishes with mustard for me.
Mm. That's really good.
You say that to anything. That's
I do love my food. To be fair. You know, it's no wonder that I'm here, really. That is fantastic. There's almost like a pickle or something in there as well, is there?
There's, you've got the mustard seed, so you might get a little pop of the mustard
seed.
Yeah, maybe that's
what it was.
Yeah, you've got,
it's fantastic.
And you've just got a subtle layer of rosemary and thyme in there, so you just get that kind of savoury herbs flavour.
Maybe shiver that has. Mm. Like that. So, and you've got on your thing, so this is your Sunday lunch horseradish sauce.
Yeah.
I wouldn't describe it as horseradish, actually. I do think it's a combination of horseradish and mustard.
It's definitely both, but the horseradish is...
And as you've said on your leaflet, mix some with your mashed potato. That's a blooming good idea.
Yeah, it is. Great.
It is a great idea.
Or with smoked salmon sandwich. See that happening?
Mm-hmm.
So yep. It's very similar to the gravlax sauce.
Yeah.
With smoked salmon and gravlax.
Sure.
Yeah, well, I like that one as well. Well done.
Good, excellent.
Right. See if we can do three
now,
for three.
Now, this I'm not sure is me.
Ah, right, we're going to convert you now.
So I was brought up in London, you know, and if we occasionally went to fish and chip shop, it was like fish with chips. That's what they did. Right. Then I moved up north to Manchester. you know, obviously later on. And there was things like their gravy.
Chips and gravy. Well, never chips even and cheese and gravy.
Seen that before. But also there used to be sort of like fish and chip shops that did curry sauce, which was, I'd never seen that either. Did they have that down south? I suppose we're doing now.
I've definitely had it down here.
It's kind of it's a bit of a cult movement. It's a northern thing, but it definitely has come down south.
So you used to go into these fish and chip shops, and my husband always used to order curry sauce because he's just, well, what can I say? it always used to look slightly green. It's got a very sort of mustardy, slightly greeny tinge colour to it. I don't know how to describe it. It's a taste all of its own.
Some people enjoy that kind of, the kind of dirtiness of
says it all.
You know,
dirty.
A greasy fish and chips. Whereas I would like to think, you know, food has evolved to a degree. And
now that's just memory. That is for me. I've just tasted that. I haven't had that for about a decade since I left Manchester. And that is curry sauce, chip sauce, curry house chip sauce in a nutshell.
People, we obviously when we go out and do our events, and people sort of turn around to me and say, it's not going to taste anything like it. But it does. And it's pretty much bang on the money. And, you know, again, I'm really pleased how the recipe, you know, evolved.
I'm not saying I like it, by the way.
Not quite converted.
No, it's just a very particular taste, and some people love it. And if you like what I call chip shop curry sauce, which is a thing all of itself, that is it in a nutshell. That's what you need to get.
But it's a much more refined version of it. I mean, you can taste individual spices.
It's a really clean recipe as well. I mean, all three of the products, but the chip shop curry actually was a bit of a kind of knocked it out of the park on the first evolution of the recipe. And I was, you know, really pleased that it's a simple recipe, and it's actually, again, a healthy, with, you know, no nasties or weird things to kind of try and do stuff to make a flavour.
Which I'm sure the chip shop curry is full of. Not your version, the original version. It's full of crap.
Lots of bright colours.
You used to go home at night with that, you could actually see your way with it. It was luminous.
We've kind of taken it out of the street and brought it up to the kind of gourmet level.
Up to my level.
Exactly.
Refined.
Refined,
like we said earlier.
So why did you start this? Is it because you're thinking, I want a bacon sandwich, shall I have red, shall I have,
Kind of.
Is that where it all started?
I just felt like, you know, that there was that space in because, you know, the food industry has evolved so much, and there's always things going on, and, you know, there's just opportunities that, you know, you don't realise are there until you've really spent some time thinking about it. And I just felt like, you know, as being a major foodie myself, I just thought, I would want that. I would want something that is, you know, a breakfast sauce that is absolutely fine-tuned to kind of sit in that mealtime. But obviously it works as a, you know, as a ketchup in a burger or whatever else. But I just felt like, you know, it's an exciting time to be alive in the food industry. You know, it's just so much stuff going on. And you just, you know, there's an opportunity, you know, go for it. And I did. And I sort of went in quite tentatively to begin with. You know, the feedback was good. So I pushed on with it.
Hmm. So how did you recognise that opportunity? I mean, we meet a lot of brands, both, you know, ones that have recently started up and ones that are more established. And it's, you know, there is no hiding the fact that it is a tricky industry with lots of moving parts. So how did you get started?
I think a few people have said to me when I've kind of been a bit further on in the journey, you know, it's lucky that you didn't know, you know, you're a bit wet behind the ears and you weren't scarred by experiences. And I did come in completely blind. Going from an absolutely standing start, and, you know, going to various events and meeting people like Paul here, who's today, you know, and chatting and understanding what I have absolutely found, undeniably, is people like myself and Paul, you know, everyone's so friendly to each other and so sort of open and enthusiastic about other things going on, because, you know, we're almost creating our own wave ourselves, you know, so it's that perpetuation that...
I've never come across a sector that is so genuinely helpful to each other.
Yeah.
Even if you find somebody else who's another sauce maker, they will chat with you or whatever. I mean, of course, it's a competitive market, but I do find...
They're sharing tips and stories, and you know, it makes you feel like you're not doing it alone, even though maybe you are.
I mean, it is tough out there, really, really tough. And that startup phase is particularly difficult. I think as I'm starting to feel like our brand is beginning to make a bit of a wave in the industry, you know, maybe my competitors aren't quite so open and friendly anymore. But
jealous.
That's, you know, that's life, isn't it? You know, that's fine.
So you started off only 2 years ago, going full time only 2 years ago, and you're based in, have I got this right, Suffolk, I think?
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
And then why did you decide to do the branding in the way that you have? Because, I mean, you have taken three very, very traditional things, which is the English cooked breakfast, you know, Sunday lunch and fish and chips, which are the three key things that you might consider are associated with British cuisine.
Yeah, very much so.
So you decided to go for those. Mm. How do you make decisions on branding? Because they're monumentally important, decisions, aren't they?
They are. I mean, I've always been, so food's been my passion and marketing and branding. You know, I never, my previous world, my previous job, I wasn't involved so in that kind of side of the business so much. So when I felt like I had my own opportunity to kind of explore.
So you're in the wonderful world of recruitment.
Sort of financial services industry, that kind of stuff, which was, I learnt a lot, you know.
Not renowned for its branding, is it?
It's not, but it is renowned for working really hard and long hours. You know, again, it's a very challenging and competitive industry. So, I mean, from a branding point of view, as you mentioned, you know, those kind of classic food dishes that we've aligned the products to, I had to have something British in the branding. You know, that was a natural instinct. And I've always felt that a brand that's got either, you know, something that's more tangible, like, you know, whether it's a creature or an animal or whatever it might be, I think people kind of get that connection. So I wanted to create something, you know, in the bottle that was really tasty and fantastic and people will come back for, but also a brand that people could go, oh, okay, yeah, I remember Salubrious sauce, you know, with the bulldog, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
So you've chosen the British bulldog. I mean, and you're wearing, you know, because you live the brand, you're wearing a sort of Salubrious
sauce. Like a rugby shirt.
Team colours, yeah.
Rugby shirt.
Yeah.
And on it is Monty.
Monty.
So you've got a British bulldog and you had to call him Monty.
Well, I had my family had a bulldog when I was younger called Monty. So that was the...
Decided.
It was. You know, the inspiration was there. So it was just really a case of putting him into a kind of format that looked good on the bottle.
And who do you think is your target audience? I mean, I'm quite happy to eat these, but I mean, am I your target audience?
Yeah, so would I. Yeah.
I mean, look, anyone that loves a full English breakfast, you know, anyone that enjoys that time, whether it's with your friends or your family, or you're sat around having that kind of engagement in that meal time. So anyone that want, you know, would have that full English. Anyone that has a Sunday lunch, anyone that enjoys fish and chips, whether it's with chip shop curry or not.
You're not going to find these things in the local corner greasy spoon. It's definitely got more of a foodie twist to it,
yeah,
I would say.
We've definitely had a lot of interest from some exciting restaurants and people in the industry that are keen to take on our products. And we've, in the short period of time, you know, we've got, you know, done some exciting things and we've got some really exciting things in the pipeline.
So where can we find the Salubrious sauce company, or do I just have to steal these and take them home?
So you can certainly buy them from our website, salubriousauce.co.uk. You can also, you know, there's a lot of independents that have been brilliant and supported us, butchers, you know, cafes.
Yeah, can see this shops. In a butcher shop.
Yeah, actually. Definitely.
Yeah, there's been, you know, there's an online, fantastic online butcher called Farmerson. They stock it. But we've recently launched in Ocado. So that's our first real step into the big,
the mainstream.
You know, yeah, right. So, and the take up, and I mean, that is literally a week, 10 days in. And the take up's been fantastic. So we're really, really excited that we're on hopefully the edge of really pushing forward.
And have you got any tips, Paul, in terms of making that next step? Because you've been doing this for a little bit longer, I think.
Yeah, I've been doing it. A long time, and I think it's something you've got to take slowly as a startup. Mm. In particular, your first step into Ocado is absolutely fantastic, and then you'll be looking at potentially going to Waitrose after that, but it's just really not to rush things, not to go directly to the bigger four retailers,
because what you want to do is get all your systems sorted.
Mm. Your system sorted, your supply sorted.
If you've got
sorted,
a delivery slot, they don't expect you to be late and all that sort of stuff. You've got
no,
to
that
be,
gets very painful if you're late.
You've got to be on time.
And usually your vehicle's turned around or your centre fine. Or
I don't think I've ever heard anybody else say, as a startup, you need to take things slowly. But I think that's actually really good, really wise advice. Because so many people, they want to rush in before they're ready. I mean, you know, you don't want to... What's the
quote? We don't want to go to market.
Sure. I think the quote is, if you're not embarrassed by your the first version of your product, then you launched it too late. I can't remember who that's attributed to, but you know, it definitely rings true for a lot of people. But
also, it gives you time to actually sort of check your product. Is it the right product? Is it the right flavors and everything? Because you only get one chance going to the big boys, as we call them. And if you make a mess of it or your product's not quite right, that's it, you're finished. And I think there's all the other things, financial strains that come on, cash flow, payment terms, everything. It's just good to take it slowly. You don't have to rush it.
And in terms of the supermarkets, if you do get supermarkets, you do get these delivery slots, which I don't think people realise. I don't think they just rock up when you're ready. It doesn't work like that, does it, Paul?
It doesn't, no. The delivery slot is gospel. You've got to come up with the right quantity of product they order. You can't
and that
be
could
short.
Be 10 o'clock at night,
it? Could be 10 o'clock at night, 3 o'clock in the morning. Your delivery slot is your delivery slot, and that's it. You cannot miss that.
And you have to deliver the quantity that you say you're going to deliver
to. You've got to deliver the quantity because you sort of... were sort of all sort of forms of penalties and everything that if you weren't there or you're short on stock, if they actually lost sales, then that could be sort of reflect on you as a supplier. And
they will delist you in an instant if they're not happy.
I think that's absolutely one of the big, you know, there are so many other companies out there that are, you know, snapping at your heels. You know, people in the startup phase now that have got some great products. And if you know, there is that pressure that if you don't kind of nail it and get it, you know, dialed in straight away, then you can fall off the radar and someone else will take your place. So there is an immense amount of pressure.
Yeah, but you see, I mean, I've been in business quite a long time and I used to think I must grab this opportunity, even though sometimes I haven't been ready. But you know what? Another one comes around the corner. Yeah. And actually, I do think you have to be ready. And you could be 90% ready, but you can't be 50% ready.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, there is definitely that sort of, that kind of gap that...
And I think going to Ocado is great because, you know, that's your first learning step and then you get used to that. Mm. And as Paul was saying, you then take the next step when you're ready, when you really nailed it.
Definitely. Because, you know, for me, you know, there's no one to hold your hand, really. There's no one, you know, yes, you can sort of, like I say, you know, bump into someone at a show and chat and ask them some questions. But when you're actually in that kind of moment where you've got to go through with it, you kind of are on your own. So, that you know, there's pitfalls out there that you can...
And are you on your own, or do you have a decent-sized team around you now?
We're getting there. We're building the team. Again, that's another challenge in itself. I'm trying to engage the right people. I mean, obviously, with a recruitment background,
you should be brilliant at that.
I'd hope I should be able to get the right team together. But yeah, no, there's some great people around, and helping us to push things forward.
Well, I like that a lot.
Yeah, I wish you all the best.
I'll leave you with your shop curry one. I'll give that to you. But I really like this thing where it's fallen between two stalls. Is it mustard? Is it horseradish? Is it red sauce? Is it brown sauce? And you're doing a barbecue sauce now as well, aren't you?
We do. Yeah, I couldn't resist. You know, the theme was the British thing. But we made the decision we had to go for a barbecue because I just absolutely adore doing barbecues. So it was just
that's becoming another British pastime, isn't it, I suppose?
It is. Yeah. Yeah, so we've...
Good. Well, very good luck to it. We're going to have a little break for a minute and then we're going to talk about... We're going to do some more tasting. Great. It's your time. It's going to be your turn to taste now, because you haven't had these before. We're going to talk to Paul Rostand of Great British Biscotti. So in the meantime, we're just going to go and have a little pre-record and we'll come back in a minute. I'm at Speciality and Fine Food Fair with Guy Routledge. I walked past the stand yesterday, actually, on the Sunday, first day, and it's a stand that said St. You, and...
Like the sheep,
yeah. And I was there was loads of people around it, but there was this thing about these eggs that are more nutritious than other eggs. Do you know, can you work that one out?
That sounds absolutely fascinating. I would hate to sound like a layperson, but I thought an egg was an egg was an egg, and you can fry them, scramble them, poach them, or a few other different things. But this sounds really, really fascinating.
Yeah. So I'm joined by Rebecca Tonks of St. You. Explain to me why your eggs are more nutritious. You know, how do you make that happen?
Well, chickens are amazing animals, and a chicken will produce really good eggs if you give her really good food to eat. It's the same as for a human, you know, you are what you eat. So we feed our hens a particular diet which has high in selenium, which is a mineral found in soil. It's quite deficient in the UK and in Europe. And we also feed them algae, which is very high in DHA, omega-3 fatty acids as well. So we have super nutritious chickens, and they deposit all that goodness into the eggs. And we test those eggs every 12 weeks to make sure that the levels are high of selenium and DHA omega-3.
So you've literally got super chickens in a way that probably most pampered chickens in the world, just so that what you feed them going in means that that actually does is reflected in the egg.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, we have super nutritious hens, and it's the way it works. Hens are a wonderful way, have a wonderful way of absorbing really good foods and deposit those into the eggs.
And sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, so it's the same minerals and nutrients and all that that you put into the food that is then present in the eggs when you harvest the egg? I don't even know what the word is.
They lay eggs, Guy.
I know
they lay eggs. They have to pull them out.
But you collect them, harvest them.
Please ignore him. Can you answer that question or not?
Yeah, so it's exactly that, really. So we collect the eggs every day. So it's those eggs that are full of the goodness. So we've got particular hens on a certain diet, which means that one flock we have ultra nutritious eggs, and other flocks we've just got kind of everyday eggs as well. Don't get me wrong, every egg is super nutritious, but we've just got one particular brand, which is our Boost the Roost brand, in a red egg box. Selenium is an amazing antioxidant, and a lot of antioxidants are red, so it just made sense to put the eggs in a red egg box, really, to highlight that fact.
And if you're a chicken on your farm, can you vote to be in the super boosty one or not?
Yeah, I don't know if we get a lot of choice in that matter, because we'll have a couple of hens that will walk across the road and go into the hen house as they please. So, yes, we've got some very, very naughty. They're over 100% free range. They help themselves, yeah.
That's really great. Now, I know you wanted to do this for a very particular reason, because your family is somewhat deficient in a certain health way, and that's what boosted your interest in this. Did you see I used the word boost there?
Yeah, fantastic. So yeah, our family unfortunately suffers from a weak gene which causes pancreatitis from quite a young age, and my father and my son suffer from it, and also my cousins. So we were looking at a way of trying to eat ourselves well, really, and really increasing the antioxidant level in our bodies to build the cell wall to make it, make sure they're strong. So when the pancreas is under trauma, it doesn't do too much damage to the cell wall, because later on in life we're much more susceptible to pancreatic cancer. This is what led us down the road of adding selenium to the feed. Selenium is a great mineral, and it is deficient in the UK diet overall, and therefore it seemed a sensible thing to do.
It makes perfect sense. And we find a lot of food producers, there is something like that kickstarts them into a particular range, doesn't it?
Yeah, in many cases. And it's that problem-solving thing, isn't it? And we see, the best businesses out there are the ones who, they either have a massive problem that they've want to solve for themselves, or they just stumble across something. And, this is a great example of that.
Can you also tell me, Rebecca, what's the difference between free range and, do they call it barn something eggs? I do go out my way to buy free range, because I'm worried about chickens being in a barn being fed loads and loads of antibiotics, which I end up consuming myself. What's the actual definition of free range as far as you're concerned?
Well, free range, we're all our farms and contract farmers are also all 100% free range. It's quite important to us. It is the kind of closest, I think, to the natural way of hens being able to perform their natural, in their natural habitats, really. All our hens across the board range really well, and I think that it's nice for the hen to be able to. If you're happy hen, you're going to produce a happy egg, so that's all good. I don't know huge amount about barn eggs, because I've not worked in that kind of sector before, but I'm the barn hens are still treated very well. I don't think there's any kind of discrepancy in that sector, but
it's just they don't go outside.
They just don't go outside. Yeah,
can't be right, can it?
Well, we're happy with producing free range, so yeah.
Eat free range is my personal opinion. You've also got an egg called Rich Yolk.
Yeah, now our Rich Yolk egg is, we feed the hens marigold and paprika pigments in their chicken feed, and they then deposit that into the yolk. It gives them most beautiful, rich colour, and people eat with their eyes, and it ticks the box.
And you've got a hashtag called Yolk Porn.
That's our marketing manager. I nearly died when she said, "Oh yeah, you've got to have that." And I was like, "Oh really?" But it is yolk porn, I have to say. When I'll bring some eggs up in a moment, and you can see what I mean.
I think you do. When I quite often have boiled eggs and soldiers in the morning after I come back from the gym. I'm starving, hungry, and the colour of the yolk somehow seems important. You know, just the way you do eat it with your eyes.
Yeah, and I've seen them from all sorts of different ranges, from very very pale yellow all the way up to almost like a bright orange. I would say that the more vivid one sounds like it's a better thing. You know, it's richer on the eyes, maybe richer inside. But I don't know, how does the colour tend to marry up with the nutrients or the flavour?
I think it varies slightly with breeds of chicken, and it also is perhaps more dependent on what's in the chicken feed, you know, as to the colour of the yolk. So lots of farmers now will have a bit of pigment in the feed, but also our Boost the Roost egg that we feed the algae for the DHA omega-3, that naturally the algae in turn turns the, for some reason, enhances the yolk colour. And I don't know, we there's not enough research at the moment, because it's quite a new thing to feed algae to hens.
At least it doesn't turn it green, so that's pretty handy.
Thank God for that, yeah.
I was going to say, how do you come up with these, you know, combinations of things? Is there lots of testing involved, or did you just say, right, we need more of this selenium, so we'll just put some in and see what happens?
No, the selenium actually it's been used in the agricultural sector for many, many years. And it's used, selenium is also great for fertility. So it's for spermatogenesis, which helps sperm swim, basically makes them stronger. So it's been used for flocks of sheep and that sort of thing in the farming industry for many years, and just not really used for human consumption.
Guy, I don't want any comments about that from you. Thank you very much.
I was just listening peacefully. I don't know what you're talking about, Sue.
Exactly right. We're moving swiftly on from yolk porn and sperm swimming. Liquid egg. Now, we've been doing some work with Black Cow and also Toast Ale. And what they've been doing is looking at how do we rescue food, make sure that we don't throw food away. So Black Cow Vodka, for example, he's a cheese farmer and was throwing away lots of the whey, and was trying to work out what to do with it, and he's ended up making vodka with it, which, by the way, tastes amazing. And the same with you. You've got, and naturally you would have a bit of wastage with egg production, and it was upsetting you, wasn't it, throwing away all these eggs?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're quite fussy in our packing centre with the quality of egg that we put in our boxes. So we do have quite a few seconds that we pull out with shell imperfections and that sort of thing. And we obviously, we go to town on nutrition. That's our thing. You know, you are what you eat, and making sure you've got high quality food isn't cheap to do, and it seems sensible then, rather than sending eggs off to a massive processor where everything gets mixed up. We're not, you know, maximising what we're doing with all our second grade eggs. So it seems sensible to set up pasteurising plants. So we've got all our beautiful rich yolk eggs that don't pass muster for the shell side of things, that go into the pasteurisation plants. So we can now produce 100% free range, 100% provenance of the West Country, and in liquid egg, yolk, white, and whole egg for the cake.
And that's for the catering industry, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And how do people get hold of that if they are in the catering industry? Because, if you're going to run a restaurant and maybe you want to get the provenance right and all that sort of stuff, you don't want to just buy in a load of egg yolks which have all been mixed together. You don't know where they come from. With yours, it's absolute top grade. It just probably is the shell is the thing that's let it down. So where could a catering company get hold of that?
We currently deal with a few distributors in and around London and in throughout the West Country. So the best thing to do is really to contact us, and we can find the best route.
Perfect. Well, I love the sound of this. I haven't tasted any of your eggs, actually, and I have to say I haven't seen any of yours, but I live in the southeast, which is quite away from you in Cornwall. But where are these available at the moment, these St. Ewe eggs?
So we've been selling our Booster Roost eggs through Ocado for a couple of years now, and we've actually they've just listed the rest of our range, so you can now get St. Ewe eggs via Ocado cover the southeast.
Brilliant. So I should be right on there getting my Booster Roost red packet eggs, make sure I'm getting my selenium up there and everything. And it's Saint, so it's that as in Saint, S-T dot, and then U, E-W-E. And your website?
Yeah, that's saintu.co.uk, so fairly straightforward.
Well, I think they're doing wonderful things. Are you impressed, Guy?
Very impressed, and I think I'm going to be going to grab one of each of these and do a bit of a taste test, because I'm just really interested to see how the difference of the nutrients makes the egg taste. Really, really fascinating.
We support Pancreatic Cancer UK, so every carton of eggs, of Booster Roost eggs sold, we donate 5p to the charity, as that's quite dear to our hearts. So, that was our good
excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Rebecca, and really good luck with it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And there you go. So we are back in the studio, and I'm joined by Paul Rostand of Great British Biscotti, and we've just finished tasting our salubrious sauce. Thank you very much, Jim Fennell.
Thank you.
Had a bit more of that while we were off air.
Delicious stuff.
It is delicious stuff. So we've got Great British Biscotti. Now, we know you quite well because you won a Food Talk Award.
Yeah.
Because we love what you do, and the judges love what you do. You've got so many different British Biscotti now, it's hard to keep up the different ranges you've got. But basically, I think you could say it falls into two. You've got the sort of sweet range and the more savoury range.
Yeah.
And as we know, Biscotti, I presume that's an Italian. It's Italian original.
Traditionally, yeah. Biscotti in sort of folklore is actually a twice-baked biscuit that's actually cooked for the Roman legionnaires. Whilst they went off sort of rampaging around Europe, they had a sweet treat that wouldn't go off. So it's twice-baked.
Because
so
it kept well.
It kept well, so it's very, very dry. There's no moisture in there, and it's a very, very hard biscuit.
Except when they're on Hadrian's Wall and it just drizzling the whole time.
that's the literal translation, isn't it? Biscotti is twice-baked.
Bis is for twice, and cotto is cooked.
Yeah.
So it's a sort of like slightly hard, but it's got a slight crumble to it as well. And we are used to it being Italian. We are used to, you know, Italian supply. I was never that fussed about biscotti because I think I didn't really have any biscotti that was proper and good. I don't know about you.
I think the only time I've ever had it in the past was, you know, served with an espresso or something like that, probably in Italy, actually, which is a nice way to enjoy it, and you have a bit of a dunk in there. When I came across you guys at the Food Talk Awards and tried some of the wide-ranging flavours, it's fantastic stuff.
And it's a texture
and very
for me
different
that you've managed to get. So what you've managed to get is slight hardness, but, you know, it does crumble as opposed to break your teeth with some of them. But they're great for dunking.
Yeah. I mean, something we've really worked hard on is the texture, to actually make sure that it is not rock hard like the traditional Italian biscotti is. Because British, we love our biscuits. We love being able to eat biscuits with tea and coffee. And I didn't want to actually sort of put us into a corner where our biscuit had to be served for dunking. Personally, I'm not a fan of dunking. I love biscotti, but I wanted to be able to eat my biscotti without having to dunk it.
I've got a dunker biscuit.
Well, it depends what the flavour is, because we've got some savoury stuff as well as the sweet stuff. I imagine dunking a savoury biscuit in your coffee or your tea is probably not.
But what I do with these is I put those in soup. Like croutons, they're lovely.
Fantastic with soups or just as a savoury snack by itself with a glass of wine at home. I just eat them with wine or Parmesan fennel, I put a bit of smoked mackerel pate on, or smoked salmon, which would go wonderful with.
You didn't bring any wine with you, though, did you, Paul?
No, I thought about it. I saw the waitress down the road.
I think we just need to get a fridge in here, and then we can just, you know, crack open a bottle whenever.
Yeah.
So I know you're constantly innovating. Do you want to try some here, Jim? Because we've been tasting your sauces. So we've got, I think these are new ones, aren't they? So we've got chocolate orange biscotti and we've got white chocolate cranberries and pistachio biscotti. What do you fancy?
I can confirm, I've just tried the chocolate and orange.
Did you take one without asking?
I did, I snuck in.
Could you not hear the crunching in the background?
Say, just trying to crunch off mic. But
try one of those.
Absolutely delicious. It's got that beautiful balance of, you know, that kind of savoury and sweetness. Again, it's got a nice, real nice crunch to it. Really nice.
What do you think? I can hear.
I'm having a crunch if you can't hear. So this is the white chocolate and cranberry and pistachio.
Yeah.
Mm. Pistachio is a very classic ingredient in the traditional biscotti, isn't it?
It tends to be sort of more almond. Once in a while you get pistachio in there, but it's a traditional sort of traditional, I say traditional, it's like a spaghetti bolognese. It can be anything, but biscotti tends to be with almond.
Very nice. And these are, we were kind of sneaking a peek at some of these before we started recording and had some of the savoury ones. And I think they were a lot thicker than the ones that we're tasting now, which are quite thin, so they're much more delicate.
Yeah. I mean, these ones, we've got sort of two different sizes. We do these, which are sort of 5 or 6 gram biscotti, which are sort of very thin, very small, sort of more eloquent. And we use those. They go particularly well for the savoury ones, which can be used as sort of canapé bases. So for canapé, you don't want something that's too big.
And that's a good idea. So you could put like some smoked salmon or some pate or something. Well, that's a really good idea, actually.
Very good, yeah.
Well, I'm not great with the sweet stuff. It's not my favourite. I do love your savoury biscotti.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
So my favourite one is the chorizo and parmesan, but you've got parmesan and fennel, which is fab.
Absolutely.
That is definitely
parmesan
one of my
and fennel is absolutely fantastic. And as we sort of touched on earlier, we also had the Indian spice, and now we've launched a jalapeno cheddar, sun-dried tomato with olives. So the flavours are sort of expanding. And with that, it actually sort of opens up the actual use of the product, whether it's used with cheeses, canapé bases.
And this for me is when you don't want a sweet biscuit, you don't want a digestive or hobnob or something like that. But it's quite grown up in that it's not, you know, it's savoury. Oh, the jalapeno one's good. And as you say, nice with a glass of wine actually, or just
snacking with a glass of wine is absolutely fantastic. Yeah. We've had crisps, we've had peanuts, we've had everything for such a long time, and I just think these come in there. They've just got so much flavour. They're packed with flavour, and a bit of chilli coming through afterwards.
And it's such a nicer thing to bring to a dinner party or something like that, rather than, you know, a bag of pretzels or chips or something. You know, it's got a talking point to it as well because it's different and interesting.
Yeah.
I had people around on Friday, and we had Bovril crisps to start. I was proud of myself for that.
I like the packaging. Like you say, if you're taking it around for dinner or something, you know, the packaging, the branding's credible and smart.
I mean, it's almost like a gift.
Yeah.
You could bring it like that. And in fact, the sauce box that you have, that you bought the three sauces in, is almost like a gift box as well.
Yeah. Well,
I think we'll be seeing a lot of that at Christmas, people giving food at Christmas.
Mm. Bit big for the stocking, but hey, you know, give it a try.
Oh, don't worry about it. What's your background? Because you have been experimenting the food sector a little bit. Has that helped inform you about how you developed the company?
Yeah, it's basically, I've been sort of working the food business since I was 17, I think, as when I first started doing deliveries around London for my father, who family's always had a food company. And I started off doing deliveries, then I was doing sort of house door-to-door sales around London, and then sort of working very much with sort of the big multiples. Sort of my passion is actually sort of creating, developing food, developing flavours. I love travelling, I've sort of travelled the world, I've found flavours, and I've sort of looked at what supermarkets do and basically tried to come in and find a factory somewhere where we could do something better and actually improve the quality of the product, because there are some horrendous products out there and it just really breaks my heart. One of my favourite dishes, chicken satay. When you go to Malaysia, you have good chicken satay. Yeah. You come here and you have a reconstituted piece of chicken on a stick and it just does my head in. It's just... criminal.
It couldn't be further from the, you know, the original that you get over in Malaysia or in Thailand.
But then what annoys me about that is that then people say, oh, well, I don't like chicken satay. And you think, well, you've never really tasted it.
Yeah.
No. I actually went to a factory and it's horrendous where literally whole carcasses were being thrown into this machine. Ooh. And it's sort of ground, round sludge came out at the end. And I thought, no, we've got to do something about this, so...
Oh, God, that's
it's terrifying, isn't it?
We need to give you a cape or something, like a food hero cape.
So you go around and you're looking at all these different things. I know you started doing this on the side, and eventually now you've given up everything and you're just concentrating on this. Why biscotti? Why not chicken satay?
I just think, again, it's sort of one of those things that's, I mean, the Italians, in fairness, they've done it well. They do have a good biscotti, but the Italians have produced almond biscotti for 2,000 years, and they've never done any other flavours in any sort of real consequence. And when I got involved with this business, I just sort of looked at it and thought there's such a potential here to do something, to branch out, make biscotti with lots of sweet flavours. And also the savoury biscotti is such a fantastic innovation. It's just, it is a new groundbreaking.
I can't believe somebody hasn't done it really before.
No.
Because it's a little bit hard, but you've got that concentrated flavour.
Yeah.
And as you say, it's very adaptable. It means you can put it in soup, you can do all sorts of things, make canapés out of it, or just have it as a really nice snack. I can't believe somebody's not done it before.
I mean, there's definitely other brands out there that have done sweet and savoury biscuits in a range.
But just for cheese, though.
That are for cheese, for example. Yeah. But never seen biscotti.
Yeah, but the cheese, traditional sort of cheese biscuits we've been given have been sort of dry crackers. I mean, very good, very good. Lots of lovely flavour, but it doesn't, to me, have the same sort of texture and the diverse use that a savoury biscotti has had. It could be used for cheese, or as you said, dunking, canapé bases. We have it sort of in take-home packs. We've got a lot of interest from hotels and restaurants as canapé bases, because they're all looking for new ideas for canapé bases, because traditionally they've been given vol-au-vent cases.
And quick as well.
Those tiny little bellinis.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
So how do you... I think it's interesting, you know, we were just talking about the sources earlier. It's not just a consumer market out there. It is business to business as well, if you can get the right product.
Yeah. Which is why, sort of, you touched on, we've got the sort of larger biscuits, which tends to be the size of biscuits that are sold in coffee shops and cafes. So we're sort of covering sort of the take-home consumer packs, the coffee shop packs, the larger packs for hotels and restaurants. So we've got really sort of quite a diverse market. And,
but if you've got a product and you think, oh, well, this could actually be great for butchers, you know, as opposed to doing it direct to consumers, or it's good for hotels, how do you go about selling in a business-to-business sense when you're in the food sector? Just contact people? Contacting.
It's the very same process. I mean, to me, my background's always been sort of dealing with Tesco, Sainsbury's and those sorts of people and selling product there under their own brand. But there was no security. So sort of what I love about this particularly is that we can deal with every high street in the country probably has potentially 4 or 5 customers that we could sell it, whether it's a shop, a pub, a restaurant, a cafe. And I just love the thought of being able to sell my product in a number of outlets rather than just 1 or 2 big supermarkets.
Because that's a little bit easier, isn't it, than being in a farmer's market, trying to sell individuals, you know, all the time. That's hard work.
Yeah. And
maybe you might sell 30 units or something in a morning. But if you can go to you know, a butcher's chain, then you know, we can get these salubrious sources in. It's a much easier sell if you can make that connection.
Yeah, we were very lucky. We have a sort of slightly secret fifth source that isn't actually available to the public. But
I don't know what they are, but I'll have one.
It's called Brewery Relish, okay? And it got 2 gold stars at the Guild of Fine Food, the Great Taste Awards. And it's actually direct for a customer. It's a pub chain, a brewery in Manchester called JW Lee's. And they identified us as a brand and they really liked what we did. And we came up with a product for them. So from a food service point of view, we've got our brand in, it's a joint venture branded product in about 120 of their pubs up in Manchester and Liverpool. So that's a really exciting kind of...
So it's not just supermarkets, is it, Paul?
No, definitely not. No. We sort of deal with quite a few of the fine food wholesalers. So a lot of our product actually goes into farm shops and delicatessens. So it's a market that I really love because it's just... Again, you're dealing with foodie people who...
Yeah, they get it.
They get it. They understand it. They like good taste, good flavours. And they're not arguing about the price all the time. You've got to be competitive, but they are interested in the product.
And so in terms of your branding and in terms of where you're going next, you've sort of given up your job now.
Yeah.
And it's all scary stuff. Mm. What sort of level of sales do you have to get now? And how many of these units do you have to sell every month in order to genuinely give up your job and make a living?
Yeah, well, giving up the job, I did that long ago. three years ago, actually. I haven't been paid for 3 years, but hopefully we're getting close to it. Yeah, in terms of level of turnover, we need to probably sell before I actually get a salary, something like 20,000 or 30,000 packets a month. So we're still quite away from that. We've got to get the, we're actually ordering new kit now for the bakery. So we're getting some really big ovens. So that will allow us to increase our throughput as well and sort of meet the demand that we're actually getting for the product.
And so have you built your own manufacturing pipeline or have you outsourced that to an existing
place? We've done it ourselves. We spent 6 months actually looking for a bakery in around England. And sort of I travelled up north, south, east, west, and could not find the right partner, somebody with the right attitude. A lot of them were, oh, in November we have to stop because we're going to produce hot cross buns or something for Easter. And we're saying, well,
that's not good for you, is it?
No. Not good for us. So we said at the end of it, right, let's just set up our own bakery. So we started with one really small oven, about 2 foot by 2 foot on top of a kitchen counter, and then sort of just really grown from there. So we started our first bakery last March, and we're now in our third bakery. So we're now moved up to about 4,000 square foot.
And how many units do you have to sell a month, you know, to keep? I know you've only been going 2 years, but to keep your business going?
It's a kind of almost like a moving target, because with growth, there comes more investment in terms of, you know, advertising, whatever it might be, staffing and so on. So that's something I think I have found very difficult is almost to try and pinpoint a particular number, because it is just a constantly evolving picture. Mm. And, you know, when you go from supplying sort of butchers and cafes locally to then scaling up to the region and then, you know, into the, as we say, the food service and wherever it might be, it really is a challenge. We're at a point, we're almost like a, you know, with the Ocado thing going so well so quickly and one or two other big deals that we've been working through, we've gone from producing hundreds of bottles into tens of thousands of bottles a month now, and that's a significant investment.
But I think that's my point really, is that, you know, you start to make something on the kitchen table literally, and then sometimes you can find some space and you can make stuff. But if you're going to do this, you have to get your head around the fact that you've got to produce tens of thousands a month as opposed to a couple of hundred, and that's the next step, isn't it?
It is, and it's just a massive challenge. I mean, it's everything you wanted and you dreamed for from day one.
Mm. And yet.
and yet you're kind of having the people say to me, come on, you know, Jim, you don't sort of pat yourself on the back enough. You know, you've look what you've achieved so far, but yet I'm my biggest critic. You know, I always want more. I'm always feeling like, you know, there's opportunities out there that we're missing because we're not X, Y, and Z. We're not doing this, we're not doing that. So, you know, it really is a massive, massive challenge.
Sometimes with those opportunities, though, there's so many of them, and which is great. It's great to have opportunities, but then trying to take each one of those sometimes has its own, you know, repercussions as well. Sometimes they're cost, sometimes they're time.
Absolutely.
And, you know, trying to balance everything and make all the right decisions at the right time. Yeah. It's a lot of pressure, isn't it?
It is. And, each opportunity requires that time and energy, and there's only one of me, or, you know, there's a few of us that can pick bits up. But also, you know, you do have a finite amount of money, and each opportunity requires some kind of financial investment and time investment. And there is luck involved. You know, some you'll pick up on and it'll go and it'll be a breeze. Others you'll put a lot of time into and it will go nowhere. I'm sure you agree.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I think there's also sort of winding the scale back as well. There's just so many in Hampshire and Dorset, where we're based, so many really small producers who are very happy doing that, and they're making a good living, and they do the markets, they do the local things. We have some sort of really great support groups around us. I mean, I don't know if you have the same in Suffolk. We've got two organisations, Hampshire Fair and Dorset Food and Drink, who are absolutely brilliant, supporting small local producers, getting them into the right markets.
But I do think there's a difference between that and what you're doing, and there doesn't seem to be anything in the middle. You've either there's a leap.
Yeah. There's a leap. Yeah.
So you either decide that's where I'm going to stay, or if you make the leap, it's quite a big undertaking.
It's a big undertaking, and as you touched on, it's all the money you sort of have coming in, everything goes straight back into it, because you need that to go to the next step. Mm. We're sort of currently investing probably close to £100,000 in our bakery to get the new ovens in, to get a bigger mixer. And it's just always, if you've got to keep growing.
And as you say, you haven't even paid yourself for the last 3 years.
No.
just keep eating biscotti.
No, it's not doing my waistline any good. That's the trouble.
Can't afford any food on the table, love, but we have got loads of biscotti. Here. Yeah. I both think you're doing really, really well. And, and you're right. Fantastic products. Bubbling under, in essence, I think, really, before it takes off. And you just got to stick with it, haven't you? Got to go for it. So if you want to find out more about any of these, you need to go to greatbritishbiscotti.co.uk, although you're available in all sorts of places now, aren't you, Paul?
Yeah, mostly sort of farm shops and delis all over the country, and likewise we'll be going into Ocado probably the earliest part of next year, January, February, yeah.
Ocado's brilliant. It really has helped quite a lot.
It seemed really supportive as well. Some of the guys that I know, Grocery Accelerator, I know that they're helping people get in there. They seem to be giving people a chance.
Which is fantastic. Yeah, they are.
So that's Paul Rostand, Great British Biscotti. And then Jim Fennell, the Salubrious Sauce Company. I'm looking at him with his bulldog with Monty on his rugby shirt.
Team colours today.
Thank you for bringing your stuff in. I do think there's a little bit of a market there, that in between bit that somehow
absolutely
has been
right,
missed.
Yeah.
Although it's quite a crowded category, quite hard, but keep going. And if you want to order those online, it's salubrioussauceco.co.uk. And where else can we find those?
Again, sort of all the independents, the Ocado, we're in Fenwick's, we're in Farmerson, which is a fantastic online butcher's, Keevil and Keevil, which are just around the corner at Smithfield Market. You know, there's a...
And I would suggest, if you've got a boy in the family and you don't know what to buy them, because let's face
it's a great present,
horrendous. There's a little box here that's sort of like a gift box with the three sauces in, which I think would go down quite a storm, actually.
I completely agree. I might be buying myself a little gift.
Put that on a Christmas gift list. So you've been listening to the Food Talk Show, which is now syndicated to dozens of radio stations across the UK and further afield, everywhere, really. Can't even bother to say how many places. Thank you to Guy. You love it when there's a bit of food tasting going on, don't you?
I have to say, I do love my food. And it's always a pleasure when we get such fantastic products in that, you know, they really taste great, they look great. We wish these guys all the best.
You're going to steal sauce and biscuits to take home.
You
should have bought a bigger bag. And if you know of anybody that's doing something groundbreaking, like our lovely guests Paul and Jim, please recommend them to us via Twitter on @FoodTalkShow. Or if you want to listen to any of our hundreds of podcasts, go to foodtalk.co.uk. Have a good week. Bye.